Session number 3901, reel number one.
Ex-Army cameraman Alan Lawson, reel one.
Mr. Lawson, when were you born?
July 1912. I was born in Gidea Park in Essex. My family moved after 3 years into the suburb where I'm living now. I went to school, I think the first term at school was at the kindergarten of the Henrietta Barnett School, which I think my father thoroughly disapproved of. Anyway, I was removed and I went to the local primary school up at Charles Way, which is still there. I went from the Charles Way School to Hendon County School, where I stayed to take matric. In those days, you know, if you ploughed one, you ploughed the lot. I ploughed the lot. so I then, in the meantime, I was training to go on the stage. I was going to be an eccentric dancer, light comedian, having had some experience as an amateur locally and at school. But by the time I was ready to leave school, my sister, who was also on the stage, had, I think, one whole year out of work, and I decided this was not the job for me. And my father, who was in the film industry as a publicity man, knew various film people, Alfred Hitchcock, people like this. And I can remember he took me up to British International Pictures, which is now the Emmy Studios up at Elstree. He also had a colleague who I think was the studio manager, a man called Walter Much. No, it wasn't Walter Much. No, Walter Mycroft, who I think had been a critic at some time or other, but become the studio manager. And I had an interview with Walter Mycroft, who said after I got a year's experience in the business, if I'd like to go back, he would give me a job. So it was almost a kind of a catch-22 position. You get the experience and then we'll give you a job. My father also had a very great friend, Maurice Elvey, who was a film director who was working for the Gaumont Company. This was before it became Gaumont British. And I was sent to see him. This was in August of 1928, I think it was, or July 1928, and it so happened I arrived at the studio the day one of the camera crew, or rather one of the members of the camera department, had left, everybody had moved up one, and so there was a vacancy for the boy on the camera department, which I got. Thanks to Maurice Elvey and the friendship with my father. I worked, the first film I worked on, which was a silent film, was Balaclava, which was being made for the Gainsborough Company. And I well remember the first day I went to the studio, I think we had a week filming interiors in the studio, various bits and pieces, and the next week they were going on location. And the whole of that week I was left behind to my own devices, which I was very upset, became very emotional, decided I was a failure after 1 week, and I got left behind. However, the third week I then joined the unit, and from then, as it were, my professional career took off. In as much as I enjoyed my life very much indeed. It was very exciting. We were filming down in Long Valley in Aldershot. Every day I could ride a horse if I wanted to at lunchtime. Needless to say, they were the leading artist horses, and they were mostly old hacks, so it didn't really, you know, there was no danger involved. However, we had a sergeant major who was in charge of the... We had a lot of troops involved, of course, and they were all recruits, and they were horsemen, and we dressed them in their various uniforms. And if the soldier got thrown by his horse, the horse used to go straight back to barracks, which was about 6 miles. So the soldier would have to walk back. And I can remember the sergeant major offering me his horse one lunchtime. And I got on the horse's back, and the horse stuck its head out. So I knew then that I'd be going back to barracks unless I was very careful, so I got off very quickly.
What did your job consist of?
I was the number boy. I used to hold up the numbers, load the magazines, unload the magazines. We had an experimental unit come down and recorded sound, but it was on full width soundtrack. They did a whole week with us recording the sound effects, and this was a company which was known as Acoustic Films. It later became British Acoustics and part of the Gaumont British organisation. But at that particular time, it was a separate organisation, Acoustic Films, same as the Gaumont Company was not Gaumont British, it was Gaumont's, and it was owned by, Bromheads, the Bromheads, that's right. Of course, after the Balaclava film,
was sound eventually used with that film?
No, it was silent. After that, I then started working on another film called The Devil's Maze, which had Carlton Hobbs, Rennie Klarmer, who I think the Bromheads had sold out to the Ostras, and the Gaumont Company was in the process of becoming Gaumont British. I'm not sure, I'm a bit hazy on that, but I think this was done. We made this film called The Devil's Maze, which was about, I think, hunting and shooting people, from my dim recollection of it. It wasn't really my kind of cup of tea. It was a... Then they stopped making that because the sound films had really reared their ugly head, as it were, and they couldn't decide whether sound films were here to stay or not. There was a... I think there was a lull of about 2 or 3 months. In the meantime, the studios were soundproofed in a fashion, and British Acoustic Films had now become British Acoustics and part of the organisation. They installed the sound system. And we then started filming High Treason, which was a kind of, it's a futuristic story of what was going to happen, I think, in 2001, probably. I can't really remember. Again, this was Maurice Elvey directing it. In those days, the cameras were put in enormous great booths, and you were shut in, and you used to get most dreadful fog inside these things. There was no air.
Can you describe the hierarchy of cameraman down to clapperboy at this period?
Well, this period, there was no... You didn't have an operator. There was a cameraman. There was an assistant cameraman who might work a second camera, or he might do the pull focus, or whatever was required, and there was the clapperboy. So usually there was... three, perhaps, on a camera unit. And if there were two cameras, well, that would be four people, perhaps five, but never more than that.
The grip?
No, your grip didn't have in those days. You might have a property man to help you, but he didn't have a grip as such. Maybe my memory's playing me up, but I don't think so.
In other words, you came in one stage higher than most people, the camera team would.
Oh, no, because you were very much the boy. You weren't allowed to do very much. It was some time before I was allowed to load, let alone magazines. I could, hold up the number board and fill in the camera sheets, but that would be it for probably about 6 months before I was allowed to load or unload a magazine. You gradually progress, as they decided you were beginning to learn, you were allowed to do more. But I didn't really start to... I suppose I started to pull focus towards the end of the time I was at the Bush. I was at the Bush for just under 2 years.
Did you ever receive formal instruction?
Not formal instruction, no. The first cameraman I worked with was Sid Bonnet, who was a delightful person, and he said, well, this is what you do, you just, this is what it is and this is what you do, and that was it, that was the instruction you got. And then it was experience from that onwards. But it was always a firm understanding that if you thought you'd done wrong, you would say so, so they could take it again. But one got an enormous variety of work. There was no specialisation, none at all. The cameraman did all the trick work. He did all the double exposures. Very little would be done in a laboratory. Optical printers didn't exist in those days. You could only add vignettes and things like this in a printer. So any special effects that are required, you did. You had to do yourself. Perhaps with... there was model work done, but of course... But again, the cameraman would be responsible for doing the model work. The cameraman who was lighting the film would be responsible for the model work. And in fact, we used to shoot the titles as well. All the main titles were shot by us. And you used to do the dissolves and the mixes and the fades and everything else in the camera. Otherwise, you see, you could have them done in a printer, but they were very poor in those days, because you didn't, as I say, you didn't have an optical printer. You could have fades done in the laboratory, but that was a chemical fade, and they used to just dip it into the solution and take it out, and that would be it. So if they did it too slowly, it was a very quick fade. So as I say, you learnt a lot. You learnt to do a tremendous amount more, which one found in the long run when I eventually went to work for the BBC after the war. I was able to do a tremendous amount of trick work that people today wouldn't be able to do. they wouldn't know where to start because they haven't had that training. But we got that. We got that training, or that experience. It wasn't training, it was experience. You learn purely by experience.
Did it take much longer to make a film then?
No, much quicker than than they're made even, you know, even today. I think the average High Treason I took, I think, which was a magnum opus, I suppose, of those days, I think took about 3 months, that was all, if that. And all the trick work that one did, of course, when you were doing trick work in the early sound days, it had to be done silent or with other tracks, and you used to have to take copious notes. You used to mark the camera gate with marks, and you'd have to work strictly to the footage counter, very strictly to the footage counter. And if you might have one magazine do one take, you take it off, put another magazine on, and do a second take, so that just in case anything went wrong, you'd always got a second chance. And your notes were always strapped to the magazine, and until you completed that sequence of trick photography, which might have been spread over perhaps 2 or 3 weeks, but you always had to go back to that one magazine. And if you got a scratch, it was disaster, of course.
What film did you work on after High Treason?
After High Treason, we finished off. We started doing the sound sequences for Devil's Maze. We finished off Devil's Maze. We then worked on a film, Alf's Button, which was made with, I think it was the original Alf from the theatre production, a chap called Edlin, who owned a pub down at Brighton by this time, a man called Alf Goddard, who was a real Cockney, I imagine probably Jewish, a blonde-haired Jewish Cockney who'd been a boxer at some time or other in his career. He was known in the studios as the lying down champion of Great Britain. But he was a great character, Goddard, and he was Alf's buddy on this. There was some showgirls on it. One of them became, I think, ultimately. She married the Rothschild. I think she was first married to an actor, then I think she married a Rothschild.
How well paid were you yourself?
In those days, £1 a week was my wage. And I can remember going to ask for a rise after I think I'd been there 18 months. And the studio manager said, if you're not satisfied, get out. Which, in fact, of course, I did. I went and got myself a job over at Stoll's at Cricklewood.
Had you been paid overtime?
Oh, Lord, no. No overtime ever paid. You worked, you know, I mean, we used to work all the hours. Never paid any overtime at all. Overtime didn't come in until, about 1938, and even then that was based usually on a 60-hour week, so you had to work the 60 hours before you collected a penny, and it was straight time then.
Back in the late 1920s, did you have a paid holiday?
Well, if you were, you know, one of the fortunate ones, don't forget this is in the period when the film industry in Britain was very shaky, actually. It'd gone through a very bad period, of course. Nobody was sure about talkies. There wasn't a lot of capital investment money knocking around, as it's now called. Only the bigger companies could afford to keep crews. I was lucky, I suppose, and yes, I did get a holiday. I think I got a holiday when I was at the bush. But it would be between pictures, as it were. I left the bush and I went to Stoles, and I got £3 a week, which was quite something.
What position were you in there?
Assistant cameraman.
Had the advent of sound affected the work of the camera team?
Yes, enormously. Particularly at the bush. The cameraman's position suddenly became that of being very subservient. The technician who ruled the roost was the sound man. He could say it's no good for sound, and that was that. No matter how good it was for the camera department, if the cameraman said it was perfect for him, the sound man said it's no good for him, the sound man would have a second take. If the sound man said it was perfect for him, that would be it. You wouldn't have a second take. Unless, of course, you'd made a complete mess of things. The sound man would say that he had to have his microphone in a certain position, and the cameraman say, well, you know, I can't light it. They'd have to alter the shot. The sound man was the king, and everything he said was accepted. That was at the bush.
Did every director respect him as a king?
A lot of the directors started to get a bit crotchety about this. They found they were being inhibited. They couldn't do what they wanted to do. They couldn't get the effects they wanted to do. This is only with certain recordists. I mean, it didn't happen to all of them, I know, because when I was went to Stoles, we had Dallas Bauer, who was a recordist, who you'd say to him, Dallas, I'm terribly sorry, but if you put your microphone there, I can't light them. He said, all right, well, we'll move the microphone up. And he'd move the microphone up and get perfectly good sound. So one then began to realise we had been taken a little bit for a ride. But of course, a lot of it was to do with the inadequacies of the sound equipment at the time. Some of the microphones which were being used were terribly insensitive, very insensitive. Others were very good. It depended on the system, really.
Which was the best system?
A variable area system was the best system to use, because it wasn't subject to the limitations of sensitivity of stock. All you had to do is to just get a black edge, but on the variable density, you had to have all the shades of grey to black to white that you can possibly get. If you didn't, you got poor sound. But at least with area recording, all you needed was a nice black image. Of course, you could make it too black and you get fringing, but that didn't often happen. I worked with British Acoustic, which was a peculiar mixture, actually, of both area and density. It was trying to get the best of both worlds, but I think it was to get round a patent, actually, that it did that. I worked with Visotone, which was an area, and I worked with density, Western, which was a density thing. Western had extremely good sensitive microphones, but again, it depended really upon the amount of money which had been spent on originally, probably on the investment.
How widespread was the belief that sound was a passing fashion, at any rate among cameramen?
Well, I would hope to think they were sufficiently realistic to know that it had arrived, but I think quite a few of them didn't think it would last. It was they thought it'd be a passing phase, because there were attempts. I can remember. Before I, in fact, went into the film business, going up to the local to see a film which had got sound on, and it was pretty ghastly. And again, it was so the camera movement was so restricted. One thought, well, you know, this will never come because of the restrictions. But of course, it did, and it's still here, still with us.
You were describing your work at Stoles.
Oh, yes, at Stoles. I went to Stoles and worked on the first sound film they made at Stoles, which was using material from a silent film which had been shot with Francis Day and it was woven into a film which had Lady Tree, Bert Coote, who was the famous windmill man, and various other people, who Janice Adair, a chap called Margeson, who was he had been a matinee idol. The film was called Such Is the Law, and it was using this silent film which had been made with Francis Day called Price of Divorce. Then after that, we made a film called The Great Gay Road with Stuart Rome. This was mostly made on exteriors at Hold Tie and Forest Row around there.
Were these successful films?
Moderately, I suppose. But you see, I think the trouble was that in those days the distribution part of this of the film business was in the hands of the Americans, and quite frankly, they didn't want British films. They didn't want them to be successful. They also had the means the means of showing them, so that British films had a fairly rough ride. And then they introduced, you know, then the Quota Act came, a distributor had to have, by law, and the cinema had to show by law a certain percentage of English films.